You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to episode 66 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Connect with us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or swing by our website, socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all. Thanks so much for tuning in. I have an absolutely fantastic interview lined up for you today. It is with Marco Ricorda. He is the social media manager for the European Parliament's president, Antonio Tajani. And just this week in Strasbourg, there was a terrorist attack outside of a Christmas market. And for those who are not so acquainted with European politics, the European Parliament has its plenary sessions about once a month in Strasbourg. So the entire European Parliament there was shut down during this plenary, and Marco and Antonio had the idea to go live and tell citizens they're safe, which completely bypasses the media filter, completely bypasses any interest journalists might have in their own reporting. And that was kind of the core motivation for this interview, but it really broadened out to picking Marco's brains about how do you do campaigning for politics on social media in Europe? What's the role of live? What's the trade-off between more content and less curation? What works and what doesn't in terms of driving engagement from a practitioner's perspective? And critically, the role of data and data analytics, which is so much missing from the European political space. So we really go all over the place in this interview, and I value Marco's perspective. He's super driven, super passionate about what he does. And in his previous work, he spearheaded Social for ALDE, which is the Alliance of Liberals and Democrats for Europe, which is led by Guy Verhofstadt, who happens to be one of the stars in the European political space, of which there's not that many. So I'd like to think that Marco really knows what's up, and he probably played a role in getting Guy to where he is. So that's just my perspective, but I think it's a super fascinating interview. I'm going to cut to it in a second. But first, I have two items of news. The first is that if you're interested in European politics, and the reason I haven't let out any episodes in the past 2 weeks, is I've been working on a 7-part podcast series called EuropeCom, which comes out of the EuropeCom conference. It's 7 interviews with different communication professionals across Europe. And I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes or whatever podcast platform you're listening on. If you're interested in European politics and what type of campaigning is going on ahead of the European Parliament elections in 2019, check out the EuropeCom podcast. I'm hosting it. It's a bit of a different format from here, but there's different intro music and outro music. I'm very proud of that. I spent a lot of time on that, but it's awesome. Check it out. I think particularly episodes 1, 2, and 5 are very key. If you're interested in European politics, if you're interested in digital, check those out. They're great. We've got people running campaigns for the European Parliament, how to tap into the mobilization potential Generation Z, and a sort of follow-up from an interview we did earlier with the Transparent Referendum Initiative and who targets me in this podcast series, looking at where they're going in the future. So that's item number one. Item number two is that the next episode is the 3rd annual Social Media and Politics Year in Review with Dr. Anna Maria Duchak-Segestin, where we define the key trends from 2018 and look ahead to what we think will happen in 2019. And we always carefully select and wrap those nuggets of knowledge as gifts. But this year, we're actually going with a concrete gift. And that gift is not only a copy of Dr. Siva Vaidyanathan's Anti-Social Media book, which was the topic of episode 55, but also a super limited, incredibly exclusive social media and politics swag pack. It's pretty cool. Like a mug, some stickers. No one has that other than, people in the know. But if you want to get a copy of the book and you want to get this swag pack, leave a review on whatever podcast platform you're listening to. Screenshot it, send it to me on Twitter, on Facebook, email michael@socialmediaandpolitics.org. Whatever you want to do, leave a review for the podcast. give us a gift and we'll do a random draw. And I mean, really, I don't think many people are going to submit to this. So if you do it, you're probably going to win. But it's cool. You'll get a social media and politics podcast mug and some stickers and a koozie, which, most people outside the U.S. don't know. But it's a little sleeve that you put your beer in, keeps your beer cold and your hands warm. It's the greatest. So leave a review, screenshot it, send it to me, listen to the EuropeCom podcast. But most importantly, listen to this interview with Marco Ricorda. He is the social media manager for Antonio Tajani, the European Parliament's president. It's a great interview. I enjoyed it, and I hope you enjoy it too. Marco, thanks for coming on the Social Media and Politics podcast.
No, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So why don't we start out, we had this terrorist attack in Strasbourg earlier this week. And what we were sort of talking a little bit, chatting on Facebook, is that you were actually live streaming from Strasbourg. So can you give a bit of context as to actually what was going on and the kind of way that you use social media to communicate with people?
Yeah, I mean, it was a crazy night. And it's also very sad because just a few minutes ago, I just heard the news that one of the people that were shot on that night, who was a 29-year-old Italian journalist, just died. So it's a big hit for everybody in the business, for France, for Europe, for the people that go to Strasbourg for the plenary session pretty much every month, and for the city of Strasbourg, which is the symbol of Europe, a symbol of peace, the city that hosts many international organizations. This needs to be put out first. It was a terrible, sad night for everybody. Now, what happened was this. Pretty much, it was a joyful night. It was the last Strasbourg plenary session, and most people in the parliament were at dinner in town or were about to go to town. And it was a crazy coincidence that the whole cabinet of the president had already gone towards the restaurant, and I decided to stay back with one of the spokespersons to work on some posts for the day. It was a productive day, and we said, okay, you know what, let's stay a bit longer in order to write a longer post about the day, which is something new for the president, something to, you know, get the citizens more into what the president does on a daily basis. And those let's say 15 minutes that we stay a bit longer were just exactly the minutes where everything happened. So we were done with the work. We went towards the president to say, okay, we can go now. And by the time the security came in and said, the parliament is sealed, nobody gets in, nobody gets out. It's like, couldn't really understand what happened. And when we understood what actually happened, I can tell you that security, they had already the situation known hours before everybody. The numbers of dead and wounded was confirmed at about, I think, 2 a.m. I can tell you, but at 8:30, the security at that level knew everything. So we knew it was something very serious. Now, apart from realizing what happened and how sad the event was, what a horrible night that became, in that moment, you have to make a choice. This happened. You have a responsibility towards the people you represent and towards the institution you preside over. So with the agreement of the team, we said, let's go live. None of the MEPs were going live. Most of them were live tweeting, but they were just sending text. I'm here. This has happened. We are all here with colleagues and staff and assistants, but nobody was going live. And I thought, we have, as horrible as the situation is, we have an opportunity to tell TV stations what is happening here, to give a sense of the urgency, but also to give a sense of we have everything under control by the man who had this role, who had this responsibility. And so we did. And then this triggered a lot of interviews requests. We were live on, on a dozen Italian TVs, exactly because they saw the live and they saw that the president was still in the parliament. So, and then the night went on, and basically we documented the whole thing. There was even a private meeting somehow, just a meeting between the president and the MEPs at about 2 a.m. It was just a logistic meeting where the president would say, a convoy will come at a certain time, be ready, don't go out. They're just giving logistic instructions. And I even went live from there. We had some doubts, like, should we do that? Yes, because at that time it was a responsibility to document that everybody was safe. So media-wise, this can be good, but it can also backfire. Some of the people, you know, on social media, or even in these kind of events, some commentators might be quite ruthless. They would tell you things like, yeah, you guys are safe, you don't worry about the people, or what do you care about people who are dying? You're just all protected in your golden parliament and so on. I mean, this happens all the time. And, you know, as disrespectful as it can be, you just take it for granted it's going to happen. But as president of the House, we wanted to give an image that the work goes on. As the president said the day after, the worst thing we could do is to change the way we work and change our habits. And this is why the president insisted that the session would go on until the work is over. Went out at about 4 a.m. in the morning, back early in the morning to continue the session. And that's exactly the message we needed to send.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you were working on, I guess, a more routine post of the day and then switched over into this new feature adoption. And I want to ask about that. I mean, first, what were you streaming exactly? What was the content that you were putting out? Was it just We're Safe or was it something more?
It's funny because like that long post that was about to summarize the day was, you know, it was a soft post. The president met some workers that were about to lose their job. And then we voted at some package on the digital market and so on. And I think the post was like a good productive day, you know. And it was posted like at 8:30 in the evening, which, by the way, it's a recommendation from Facebook. Longer form posts in politics work better at dinner time. So we really followed that recommendation. And so it was like a diary, like a long productive day. Today I've done this, and that, and these people came. Literally 5 minutes later, a terrorist attack in the city. What we were streaming, honestly, I don't remember anymore exactly what went out. I think we went live about four times. Firstly, it was a message from the president telling his followers what happened. And that was the only one where the president knew he was filmed. And what's funny is that, I got to tell you this. So we decided to go live, no editing, we just go live. And the phone started ringing very loud, exactly during the live stream. And he just, you know, keeping his cool, you know, he's the president is a captain in the army. He was a journalist. He kept his cool, gave his phone to an assistant, and just kept documenting what was happening. The rest of the streaming was about twice. It was him doing other interviews for Italian TV, so that people could tune in and then watch the interview on their channels. And then the last one was exactly what I said before. It was the documentation of this logistical meeting to indicate to the MEPs what they had to do. Now, I want to go back to the first streaming. I went the first streaming with the actual message where the president knew he was filmed. I sent that to a few journalists in Brussels saying, hey, we have something exclusive here. He is the only person in the parliament who is live streaming what is going on. I suggest you follow us on social media throughout the night because it's going to be quite a night. Listen to this, since you mentioned the Brussels bubble before. A very notorious journalist in Brussels told me, Marco, I can't do anything with that video. The sound is not great. I mean, seriously, it was like a bored response, like send me something better. My girlfriend, who is outside of the bubble, doesn't know anything about politics. She said, I loved that video, and I loved that the phone rang and the president kept his cool. And for me, that is a victory. The moment we can send a message that gets to the people instead to the bubble, that's the moment communication wins.
That's super interesting. So I've seen Antonio Tajani speak before. He's a big charismatic guy. I know you said, I didn't know he was in the army, but.
He's still an official. He's still an official. Once you are in an official in the aviation, you are for life.
Okay. It's like an ambassador or something like that. You get to keep the title. Cool. I want to ask about how you guys roll kind of on the day to day with you as sort of running the social media and him as, the main figure of those accounts, right? But first, about this live feature adoption, I mean, what was the kind of consultation process? Was this something that you suggested or was it something he suggested? And I mean, what was that? Because when you're under so much pressure, it's kind of like, you know, you got to make a snap decision, more or less. So how was that talked out or decided upon?
I suggested that and he was up to it. That's it. I got to tell you that in another circumstance, when he was a bit busier, he pretty much said it's, Let's put it like this. He pretty much said, not now. Let's use these words, like not now. And this is why the other videos, it was not filmed. Because during these moments of pressure, when you're giving so many interviews and you have to be firm and you have to be clear, and it's 4 a.m. in the morning, you don't want to stress the person you work for. And if you go there with your phone like this, you're adding some extra stress that would ruin the product. And it would also disturb a person who has an enormous amount of responsibility on his shoulders. So we said, okay, we're going to do this now. But then my suggestion is be discreet. Don't be intrusive. Understand that there is a need for social media, but there is also a need to respect a person right now. So we went live once. He was up to it. We did it. And that was it. Now, why live instead of a video? Because live is exactly meant in all the platforms, it was always, let's say, conceived from Periscope at the beginning to Instagram Live today. It's meant for things that are happening now that you wouldn't see on TV. So people are, you know, they enjoy peeping into people's lives or into situations that are usually, let's say, not so easy to access. We were talking about a situation where the parliament was sealed. There is a media center in the parliament, which is on the other side of the aisle. So it's about a 10 minutes walk for us. We didn't know what time we would be there to then go live. He was going live on phone interviews. We needed to give people a product. It was exactly what every online live platform is meant for, giving access to a place that is usually inaccessible. And that was the office of the president during a terrorist attack.
Yeah. So, and I'm sorry to interrupt. I think it's what's great about it is that you're going directly straight to the people, right? You're bypassing the journalist gatekeeping or media filtering. And I wanted to ask about your perspective in that more broadly. I mean, I think it's personally great for, you know, democracy representation to go straight to the people. But in your experience, I mean, is it the time aspect that's important, going straight to the people, or is it being able to communicate directly without that media filter?
It is both. I mean, every media strategist has, we all have our own approach. So somebody might be more careful, more diplomatic. Somebody might focus more on curation. I'm more on the Gary Vee style. So volume, frequency of content, and live. In that case, the situation was so specific and special that needed, that there wasn't a product that was better for than that, in my own opinion. This is the way I work. This is the way I've always worked in politics since the beginning of my career. In my experience, it always paid off. You said there is a need for, you know, is it speed versus image? It's both. And you have to read the situation, in my opinion. And when you work in politics and you're doing the press or media for a politician, there is always a balance between the strategist who proposes, and then the politician, the celebrity, the athlete thinks and accepts. But my way of working is that if I believe something is right, I don't say this works, this doesn't work. I propose things, and in a way that the politician feels at ease to accept. And once he sees that these things work, he will give you access to his life. I think that's a step, that's an initiation process that every media strategist working with politicians especially need to go through at the beginning. You earn trust by proposals, not by asking for demands or, let's say, imposing things and trying to make yourself considered as somebody who knows more. No, they know more, you propose, and with proposals come results.
Yeah, because I wanted to follow up on that, because you've also worked with Guy Verhofstadt, if I have that.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, and so I want to ask, like, how important is the, because both, I think, Guy and Antonio are very charismatic. Is that, so you're saying you have to build trust with the politician, but to what extent does the politician's personal qualities affect their propensity, I guess, to adopt social media?
Enormously. I have to tell you, I mean, President Tajani was a journalist for a long time, so he understands the value of the media. I think if Verhofstadt understood it well before and beyond most members of the European Parliament, he's currently the second most followed MEP on all social media, right after Nigel Farage, who is, you know, a politician on the completely opposite political spectrum than a liberal like Guy Verhofstadt, but they're both charismatic. So media-wise, Guy Verhofstadt and Nigel Farage are incredibly charismatic. And in fact, if you go on YouTube and you type Guy Verhofstadt, if you watch a video, the second video suggested would be a video from Nigel Farage. So and vice versa. So I think, yeah, the propensity for social media is very personal. I think there has been an adaptation curve. Let's say in the US, they were very well ahead. Obama started a Facebook page back in 2007. I think Guy Verhofstadt really capitalized on social media just a few years ago. He was a late adopter and then really caught up and invested both in, I mean, content and effort, especially on Facebook and Twitter. But I have to say something. His speeches are very shareable. The way Verhofstadt speaks, and this also comes from the way the speeches are conceived, are very easy to share. Why is that? Because he endorses global causes, not necessarily giving them a political brand, which is the key for political shareability. If you say, let's save the environment, and you don't put a political logo anywhere, the content is shareable because everybody wants to save the environment. Not necessarily you're giving solutions or proposals to save the environment, but if you say, let's, you know, work for peace, let's work for unity, you never put a logo, that's shareable. That goes viral.
Man, I'm writing down. I'm writing down so many notes. I have so many questions for you. But I want to ask specifically on that, do you think that with the popularity of social media and with some politicians, especially in European politics, which is not particularly the most sexy, getting notoriety via social media, do you think that affects the content of their speeches in order to get those, you know, sound bites or those clips that would actually, because before I would imagine that speeches in the European Parliament don't really get any visibility outside of, you know, a very interested group.
Well, I mean, I can tell you that Guy Verhofstadt's speech against Orban, I think, got 10 million views. 10 million views on Facebook.
I remember that one.
That's a good question. In my experience, no. I'll tell you why. So a speech is a speech. It's a long-form content. And then what you extract out of it can become content for social media. So a speech can become 7 tweets, 3 Facebook videos, 3 Instagram stories, a Instagram post, some snaps. So the way I work is maximization of content. And if the speech is long, then you have the opportunity to hit different audiences with different products. People that then get the feed on social media, they don't know there is a speech in the plenary. But if the speech is rich of topics, and it can even be a bit longer, long-winded. I mean, then you have techniques to cut the pauses and so on. I think a longer speech is always better. I don't think speeches need to be snappy. I think the extraction and the editing of the content needs to be snappy. But if the speech is rich, it's just more content for you. I mean, this is we managed to get Guy Verhofstadt 300,000 likes in about a year. That was more than in the previous seven, exactly because I wanted to maximize the production of content according to activity. Compared to Tajani, so Guy Verhofstadt's agenda is way smaller, of course, but the content we produced is a lot more frequent. So we managed to really maximize content per activity in a way that was shareable by a lot of people without endorsing a specific political party. The president of the parliament has a limitation in remaining incredibly, well, extremely institutional because he presides over the house. A politician that fights for a seat for the elections doesn't have this limitation, which of course helps incrementation and the publication of content, which gave Guy Verhofstadt and Nigel Farage incredible visibility over the past few years on social media.
I want to ask about that. I was reading your Medium post. I'll link to it in the show notes about less curation and more volume. But first, I want to ask about this specific institutional aspect or, you know, I don't know, limitation, as you said. What concretely does that mean for social media communication when you have someone who is in a sort of high institutional position versus someone who is sort of freewheeling on the campaign trail?
It's completely different. It is completely different. I mean, when you're campaigning in politics, you have no boundaries. I mean, if you don't have an institutional role, whether you're, you know, it can be a commissioner or a president of the commission or the council or the parliament, you have a lot of boundaries because you represent everybody. But I mean, for the parliament, it's a bit different because before being president, Tajani or like Schulz before, you are an MEP. You are a member of the parliament and you have the right to express yourself. But in the house, you need to be so comprehensive of everybody's views that it makes it very hard to make content shareable because you cannot be that punchy unless you're calling for unity externally from the house. When you are campaigning, the more you go rough, the more it gets views. So you're actually encouraged to be controversial because it is controversy that is shareable. Controversy and the attempt to polarize voters or followers is what works. And exactly this kind of approach, you know, less curation, more volume, goes in that direction. Because if you keep hammering on a topic, the more controversial it is, the more you will gain traction. And so if you gain traction on a platform, something that also implemented with Verhofstadt was that we went on all platforms. Verhofstadt is on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, YouTube, LinkedIn, Medium. This mass, this critical mass of online interactions help all platforms. There is a correlation. If you're strong on all platforms, and let's say you want to be strong on one platform in particular, let's say Facebook, more platforms, more visibility will help that. It is a misperception to say, oh, if we invest in another platform, this will diminish. Not at all. It is the very opposite. There is a global online indexation of keywords. And if your politician is everywhere, all platforms will benefit.
Yeah, and this is what you discuss at length in this Medium post, is this idea of being present as much as you can. More content is better than sort of polished content. And I buy that. Yet it can't be that simple, right? There has to be some strategy for how you select what to put where. So I want to ask you about that cross-platform approach. So pick any example you like, whether it be Guy or Tajani or whoever. But what is your thinking when you're approaching this? Okay, I have all this content. I've taken a long speech. I've chopped it up into all these shareable bits. How do you go about pushing it across different platforms in order to maximize the shareability, for example?
Yeah, I mean, of course, not every content goes everywhere. You just have to think, what are people expecting when they are on their phone and they are on Snapchat or Instagram or LinkedIn or Twitter? What are they expecting? So, I mean, this is something that will never change. And also, what kind of people are using these platforms? Now Facebook is for old people. So the message you're putting on Facebook, that video about what we're going to do with the budget, okay, can go on Facebook. It can go on Facebook, no problem, because you have an older segment of the population. that is there. If it's about the budget, it can go on LinkedIn and on Twitter. It wouldn't go necessarily on Instagram and Snapchat. If it is about terrorism, you know, this can go cross-platform, but definitely not on LinkedIn, because the average person on LinkedIn is either looking for a job or trying to enhance his professional brand and looking for content there. And he doesn't want too political stuff there. On LinkedIn, you want the technical stuff. So think about the guy behind the phone. I'm not even saying laptop. I haven't bought a laptop in like 10 years. Think about the person behind the phone. Is he wearing a tie? And is he an office worker? Then don't put a political content there. He's looking for a job. Is he looking for entertainment? Then put a punchy speech on Facebook that lasts 15 to 30 seconds. Put yourself in the shoes of the person behind the phone. Without that, that's a strategy behind it, you know. And this changes pretty much every 6 months. I mean, the change for Facebook, you know, it's been the most significant, in my opinion. Now, I think that kids between 13 and 20 are mostly on Snapchat, and 16 to 24 are mostly on Instagram. They don't even have Facebook anymore. So, you know, why putting content that is not meant for them on Instagram? There is no reason.
And where do you get these your ideas about these insights? Is it just personal experience? Are you reading this kind of social media marketing literature? Or is it just trial and error? What do you think?
All of that. I mean, I think I have the chance to be one of these very few people that has been doing that in 2018 for 10 years. You cannot have more than 10 years experience on social media, because roughly there wasn't any, unless you were already doing business on MySpace back in 2006. But it's all of that. I made a lot of mistakes. I mean, let's get it short. I love what I do. And I am happy to read books by Gary Vee, by other marketers. I think that the way I learn the most is at conferences, like, you know, big conferences about social media, like the Social Media Week or, you know, the Web Summit and so on. That's where I get the most, because when you go to these places, you have this excitement, you meet a lot of people. And if you have to study the literature, like the books I have here in my studio, It's work. While at the conference, it's fun. And also, you know, at a conference, like, you listen to these people. At work is a bit different, because you never know the credential of the person that claims they know about social media. Unfortunately, social media is a discipline, is a field of study where everybody thinks they know. And very few actually invest in the literature at going at conferences. So a lot of people that even don't work in social media, they have the expectation to be listened about their ideas on social media just because they use it. And, you know, to convince clients sometimes, or people you work for, can be very hard. So I think if you want to excel in this job, if you want to create a name in the business, you have to go beyond that. You cannot just be a user. You need to study the literature. You need to follow the people that have made a big change in digital marketing all over the world. And thirdly, there is something that is incredibly underestimated. Meet the people from the companies. I get a meeting with Facebook, with Twitter, with Snapchat, with Instagram. They have an interest in you maximizing the use of their platform. And they will give you insights that nobody, not even Gary Vee, has.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you got to come to an academic conference one of these days, because I read these blogs. I'm not familiar with the in-depth marketing research. But yeah, the academic stuff is a bit more hardcore and probably a bit slower. So I think it must be exciting to be on the forefront. But we deal with a lot of data. So we analyze a lot of, you know, tweets from elections maybe a year ago or 2 years ago. So I'd like to ask your perspectives on the importance of data and analytics. How much do you take that into account when you're iterating on your campaign strategies?
Unfortunately, I mean, my background actually was, I was a social media analyst for 3 years in the European Commission. So that is my background. I have to say right now, I follow my guts. But I think that ahead of elections, a data analyst makes a difference between winning and losing. I mean, I have to be blunt. I have to admit right now and in my previous work, I wasn't doing that much reporting, especially on big data, especially on understanding what people care about. I think everything comes from there. Let's say you're doing a new Facebook ads campaign, okay? So the common mistake you would make here is, okay, I want this video. I have 1,000 euros to promote this video, okay? And I will send it to people that are interested in Europe, in the European Commission, in politics, in voting, in democracy.
Yeah, you kind of drop down interest.
Exactly. So what actually makes sense, and there's so many companies now that do that, they will tell you, it is pretty much what Cambridge Analytica were doing illegally, but there are companies that do it legally. So now there is a misperception about using this data. If the data is public, this is legal. And basically, you know, instead of targeting people that already somehow have expressed an interest in politics, so these are people that you don't need to target because they will already be following you.
Exactly.
You can target people that, let's say, I give an example that I've done recently. I will not tell you for whom. So we need to promote something, and instead of and this content was somehow a bit satirical. Instead of targeting people that were interested in politics, we targeted people that were looking for entertainment because the post was political but entertaining. And so I went for like people like Netflix, people like some football teams, people like some TV shows that are usually watched by the target audience we aim for. If we had targeted, you know, people interested in politics, it would have gone at nowhere. This is exactly the job that data analysts do. And in campaigning now, it makes the difference. And we've seen it with Brexit. We've seen it with Trump. We see it all the time. It makes the difference between winning and losing.
Well, I'm glad someone gets it in the European political space, because I've been beating this drum, particularly at Europecom this year, where I don't know to what extent because of Cambridge Analytica that there is this sensitivity around data. But I mean, obviously, the core dynamics of campaigning, research, polling, bringing that into lookalike audiences and targeting particularly on these strategies you're talking about. In the academic literature, we know that people don't follow political pages. We know they're not interested in politics in political realms. But if you go to forums like gardening, parenting, political action occurs out of those forums because people share a common interest and it's not polarized. So, yeah, I mean, and to what extent, when you're thinking about these things, looking between online and offline? So, I mean, are you doing polling? Are you doing canvassing in the field? I don't know, focus groups? Or are you only working with online data?
In my position, I don't do that. That's more the job because I'm not tied politically. I'm not a member of a party. That is the job for the parties. And for instance, you know, I've been to a bunch of seminars of political parties in the ALDE family, so the family of the liberal parties in Europe. And then they do canvassing. And I have to admit that the most advanced were the Scandinavians.
Really? The Scandinavians?
Beyond reality. I mean, I think there was a campaign in Norway where people, like, you know, there was a map and they would tell you exactly in that street they're more socialist, in this street they're more conservative, in this street more liberal. So they took it beyond really anything. In the south of Europe, we are far behind in this kind of canvassing. I think, you know, also because Norway has maybe 6 million inhabitants and Italy has 60 million inhabitants. So that makes it hard. But I think there is just more conscience in Northern Europe about there is also a different, you know, civic sense. So people know each other more. There is this big sense. That's how you pronounce it, right?
Yeah. Cultural homogeneity, if you will.
No, there is a way. Society blends in is a bit different. I think Scandinavia is way beyond that. I think when it comes to political campaigning, especially at the local level, it's crazy important also to make yourself seen and show the effort that you're going house by house. I think that will lose relevance as it has done over the past few years, but not everybody lives in big urban areas. I've given seminars where people from, you know, came from a rural area in Estonia, and I was like, wow, I cannot tell these people, yeah, go on Facebook and do targeting. Like, no. Every situation is different. I think that the mistake of centrist, moderate, and liberal parties over the past few years has been this: to underestimate the electoral system over the strategy. What do I mean? Everybody thought that Hillary was going to win because overall, the survey showed that millions of, which is exactly what turned out, millions of voters more were for her. But the electoral system is not, you know, an absolute number. There are algorithms. And I think that's exactly also what happened in other elections. So firstly, how are people elected? Is there some kind of algorithm? Is it proportional? Is it seats by seats? Is it by circumscriptions? Are there some certain councils have more power? Okay. Start from the electoral system. Then you do the strategy for the campaign. Most centrist parties, pro-European parties, liberal parties, have done the opposite. And so they have completely screwed up the whole analysis. While parties like Front National in France, Geert Wilders, League in Italy, Five Star Movement in Italy have done the opposite. They have put all their budget in strategists and data analysts and then did a very cheap communication. Whatever is out, hammering 50 tweets a day, but backed by analysis. And the others did the opposite. Let's send pan-European messages that are understandable to everybody. And when you try to communicate to everybody instead of small segments of people, you end up communicating to nobody. That's the mistake that Europe is doing. That's the mistake of Europe is doing. European institutions do pan-European campaigns in English intended to get to everybody that eventually gets to nobody.
Yeah, well, we got a few people working in the different parts of the institutions. I'm sure they are listening with interest.
Well, I mean, I'm even Eurocritical because, I mean, it's critique that makes a debate interesting and productive. I'm not a skeptic because if you're a skeptic, you don't believe in it. I'm the most critical person about EU communication we'll ever meet. And I've been working on it for all my career.
Right. Okay. Well, let's keep it. I got two last questions for you. We'll keep it on this this European theme. One has to do with exactly this. I don't know if you want to take a position on it, but you know, the European Parliament elections are coming up next year, and those campaigns generally go in these kind of 3-month, 4-month phases. So, I mean, the campaigning for the EP election starts 9 months, 12 months before the actual elections go. So this year, the European Parliament is doing quite a bit of initiatives in terms of this time of voting campaign, the what's going on in my region. Do you have a position or a feeling about how that campaign is going? Do you think that is effective in order to drive voter turnout?
It's very early. It's very early. I mean, now, what is it now? I mean, we are 7 months away from the elections. It's very early. I mean, if you make an impact now, people will get tired before the actual vote. I think April will be crucial. So honestly, I cannot make an assessment. I think that something that is currently not considered or has never been considered, even, you know, in these conferences like EuropeCom, I have suggested this topic a bunch of times. It was always disregarded. It was the use of influencers to endorse a behavior. So if the European Parliament tells you, go to vote, you don't care. But if an athlete, a singer, some kind of celebrity tells you to do that, you do. You care about. You listen. Not necessarily this needs, you know, to be a paid performance. Like, you know, okay, I want this famous Instagrammer to send a couple of posts. No. Convince them that it's a good thing and they will do it for you. If I was in charge of it, I would say, I want 30 lobbyists, 30 public affairs experts to lobby celebrities to talk about the elections. And I would put most of the money there. instead of putting it on campaigns that are meant to be published by the parliament. Because you will not listen. I mean, maybe I'm making things too simple and I am underestimating the amount of work that would take. But if we are not bold today, you know, we are losing, we are risking to lose Europe as we know it. When will we do it? The 27th of May of 2019 will be too late to complain. My opinion, the time is now, and the mobilization of influencers will make a difference in having another low turnout of 35% in Europe or a big turnout. I think that if they don't manage to get 55% at least, then it would be a failed communication campaign.
So last question, you precipitated it a bit, but I guess I'll just ask, what do you think then would be your sort of prediction, not on voter turnout, but just in the way that the digital campaigns roll out? Will there be a difference between European political parties, the EP, national parties? I mean, what's the state of digital campaigning ahead of the 2019 European Parliament elections? As you see it, what's your prediction?
I mean, let's talk about the stage of campaigning, because everything is digital. So, I mean, people vote for their party. They will not vote for the party that, according to them, will give them the best benefit in the next 5 years because they go to elect European members of parliament. People will vote for the party they like now, whether it is regional, local, national, or European election. So we don't have transnational lists in Europe. People will vote for their party. So I can tell you this. Eurosceptic parties have already mobilized thousands of people to proactively do some online commenting with the message, we're going to change Europe in May, and we're going to, you people from Brussels, send you home. If there isn't a reaction right now from the other side, it's going to be too late. So they started already to exactly, but they don't do it themselves. They ask others to endorse their message. So the parliament needs to encourage turnout. That's their goal. They cannot encourage to vote for one part or the other. And so needs to do all the European institutions. The parties will go heavy. Currently, the Eurosceptic parties seem to have more power digitally than the most moderate. The moderate now need, I'm not saying to become like the populist, but they need to take a stronger stance. If I mean, I see very few parties. I would say maybe a good example is Ciudadanos in Spain, who are doing that, who are attacking with proposals that go against the Eurosceptics. But I see a lot of laziness from the moderates around Europe, which frankly worries me.
Yeah, okay, so now this is the last question, which is, I've been thinking about this a lot because I've been looking at the research and it's clear the Eurosceptics, or nationalists, populists, whatever you want to call them, they're more active online. You said earlier in this interview that it's the negativity, the polarization that drives engagement, that drives shareability. And that's always been my sort of question is why don't the pro-Europeans attack the Eurosceptics and get that type of digital engagement? Because wouldn't that be a viable strategy? I mean, you don't see it in national politics and you don't see the European politics. But I think instead of appealing to centrism, which clearly doesn't work over the past how many years? I mean, do you think centrist parties should go more on the offensive? And it doesn't have to be a battle of reason. It can be playing the same tactics because we know what works online, right?
I totally agree with you. I mean, I've given a bunch of seminars that show how populist nationalist parties have a consistent digital might way superior than the moderate, let's say, the moderate liberal centrist parties around Europe. This is given. Honestly, I don't know what is this reticence behind that. I can tell you that the ALDE group was different. The ALDE group invested extensively on social media. And I think also, you know, this reflects on their performance because they were the most performing group in the parliament. I think one thing, this is my interpretation, and take it as it is. Centrists, so politicians, have the interest to always be on the good side of history. So liberals have more an interest to never say something wrong rather than being dairy, and say something that 3 years from now can backfire against them, because liberals and centrists care a lot about the principles. So they will never want to be on the wrong side of history. They will never take a populist approach to get votes, because it will put them on the wrong side of history. The extremes, left and right, they don't have this fear. So pretty much, I think this is my interpretation. Working for the liberals, working for a prominent liberal politician, you never want to make that mistake, because it will be shameful for you for life. This doesn't mean you don't have to invest on social media. And in fact, it's not always the case. I can tell you that the VVD, so Mark Rutte's party, who won the elections in the Netherlands, I think they hired 25 people just to respond to comments on social media. Guess what? They won the elections. Just because they gave people a feeling that somebody was listening. So I think things will change, but I think that this approach of avoiding polarization will always be inside the heart of liberals. You know, being a liberal doesn't mean you are part of the ALDE group. You have liberals in the EPP, you have liberals in the socialist group, you have liberals in the extreme right, in a way. Being a liberal is this, is fighting for liberalism and always trying to be a progressive, forward-looking politician. Then, you know, you don't want to risk your principles over votes. And this is a choice you make or you don't make.
Well, Marco, it's been super interesting, and also getting super late as well. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing your insights with us. I think it's been really enlightening.
Thank you. And best of luck with your studies, with your research. I'm sure you'll do great.
I've just been speaking with Marco Ricorda, social media manager for Antonio Tajani, the European Parliament president. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Don't miss next time when Dr. Anna Maria Ducek-Segestin from Lund University joins us for the annual Year in Review. You can catch a live stream of that up on our Facebook page. And don't forget to check out the Europe.com podcast and rate and review us for a chance to win a Social Media and Politics swag pack. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Copenhagen. See you next time.